All right, guys, welcome back to week six, hour number four of Pendragon. Maggie's Hadoukening the screen or something. I don't know what that was about. I guess so. Cool. So, Steven, what's going on?
So, poor Sir Quinn and Sir Philip both lie split in half in the mud and the dust at the bottom of this forest. And Sir Emrys is praying to his god, and Sir Lunette is just shocked at the wanton destruction of her closest allies. So, what do you guys do with these bodies, and what's your reaction to what has happened?
Well, we know for sure that Quinn is just gone.
Well, I mean,
we understand that he's just gone. There's no hope of saving him.
You understand that he's not going to survive. His breathing is growing shallower. He's losing blood quickly, even though Nud has performed admirably on first aid. He's just too damaged.
And he's unconscious?
Yes.
What, back in those days, what was like the most honorable way to die?
As a knight, the most honorable way to die is to go out in battle against another knight. So even though, Sir Philip had been driven mad by his recent experiences, Sir Quinn did still have an honorable death, and you can, carry his body.
He's still alive. He's just unconscious.
slipping closer to death with every passing moment. Yes.
What I'm saying is, should I just kill him outright?
I don't think that you would consider that an honorable
knightly
thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we would try to take him
back. I think
back.
You might, for example, like sit vigil with him all night as a religious knight and
sure.
like pray to God for guidance and, pray for the salvation of his soul and maybe his body.
Okay.
But,
And I would think with the two pieces of Philip that his mother would at least like to see her son in some fashion, no?
It's possible, certainly.
I would do the best to collect the pieces.
The parts, yeah.
And take those back to Gwendolyn or whatever her name was.
Gwended?
Gwended.
I think it's Gwended.
Magdalicious?
Yeah,
Magdalicious.
And as I approach Nud, what is his state of being?
He's probably in shock.
Yeah, Nud is just standing there with like spattered blood all over his face. He's just like, he's never really seen furious knightly combat before. He's used to killing animals and butchering animals, so. It's not like he's shocked at the sight of blood, but he is very shocked at the sight of human-on-human violence.
I would say I would ask Nud what he has seen today.
What do you mean?
Like, what did he just see? What is his... What does he think of the situation?
He says, what did I just see? I just saw the mad Saxon cleave in half your companion, and then you struck him down with your sword. Most honorably, Sir Knight, thank you for destroying the mad Saxon and protecting the realms.
I look at Sir, or Lady Lunette, Sir Lunette, whatever, and see like how she reacts to that and ask, do you want our friends to be remembered this way?
Remembered what way exactly?
The way that Nud tells it. Or should we perhaps rewrite history?
What are you implying?
Sir Philip did not go mad. Sir Philip slayed a giant, and that is why he has this sword. And Sir Quinn came into the forest looking to defend Sir Philip with this fight, and the two of them slayed the beast. However, it took mortal wounds themselves. And we happened upon them in the forest after the fight.
I like this tale that you tell, Emrys. And I think it portrays our friends in the light that they should be.
And I turn to
and
to
like
Nud.
Tears are streaming down my face, and I'm like praying.
I turn to Nud and take off my helmet, my visor, and undo that, et cetera, et cetera. I say, Nud, is this not what you have seen today?
And he says, Sir Knight, by my troth, it is as you say. A great giant was fought and slain by Sir Philip, who was not mad, and then Sir Quinn was struck down by this selfsame giant in defense of Sir Philip. And here we have the sword as evidence to return.
Very well, let's collect these bodies and go tell the tale.
Yeah. So Nud helps you gather up the bodies and drape
Maybe
them
we,
over
like,
a horse.
Maybe makeshift something with the wood to carry them on.
Yeah, certainly. You can, you know, makeshift up a stretcher or something like that to carry them back home on. All right, so you managed to both of you get out of the forest fairly quickly and easily by following your tracks back. You make your way back to Dinton, the manor. And you're...
Okay, I say, Lunette, let me go speak with... God damn it, what is her name?
Gwyndid?
Let me go speak with Gwyndid, for it is not a pleasant thing to say that not only has she lost her husband, but 20 hours later, she has also lost a son that she just found out she had. So I go inside and
I just continue doing prayers for the two that have fallen.
Yeah.
I go inside and what do I see? Like, what is she doing when I...
She's just sitting, you know, mourning, weeping, praying at a makeshift altar.
Okay.
And just in front of a cross with a little candle lit in front of it.
I just
And
say,
she hears your approach and she turns around and she says, Sir Emrys, you've returned. Tell me, what news? Your face looks grave.
Lady Gwyndid, I come with the grave news that your son, who is not the Mad Saxon, was unfortunately slain in the forest.
Slain in the forest? What mean you of this?
He was battling a giant, one of the largest and most ferocious men I have ever seen, maybe not even a man. And in this fight, he did slay the creature, but he also took a mortal wound. And he is no longer with us on this realm.
She like closes her eyes and she passes a hand over her brow and she says, Sir Emrys, I thank you for this news. Though I suspect you perhaps are saving me from a harsher truth. But in truth, Sir Emrys, my son was dead to me many years ago when he never returned after his trip to Cornwall. And so, though I have lost both a son and a husband, the blow is not so harsh. But I thank you for delivering me this news today. And if it be true that there was indeed a giant, did you bring the sword back, by the way?
Yes.
Are you like showing it to her as evidence?
I would say I brought it inside, yes.
All right. And well, she takes a look at it and she says, truly, this is a weapon which could only be wielded by a man of incredible strength and valor. And it must have been a giant who originally had this weapon in his possession. So it must be, as you say. Thank you for letting me know of my son's final fate.
I say we do have his remains outside if you wish to bury him. I will reside over the funeral if you wish.
She nods and she says, we may lay him to rest beside his father. Wait. On second thought, perhaps he would not appreciate that. Let us lay him to rest in the vineyard, which was always one of his favorite places as a boy.
Very well. I go outside, collect the body, and do whatever I need to do to have the funeral happen. And I tell Lunette of the conversation inside.
Yep. You speak at the funeral and preside over the proceedings, and it's very touching. Are you guys trying to bury Sir Quinn in the same location, or are you like ferrying his body back to back to what was yours? Berwick St. James?
Berwick, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, he'd be buried in his manor. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Even if the we would do our best to keep the body.
Yeah, I mean, it's only been a day or two, so
yeah.
It's not so bad. Yeah, so you preside over the funeral for Sir Philip, and then you take Sir Quinn's body to Berwick St. James. And his entire family and all of his retainers come out, and there's much weeping and tearing of clothes and, you know, mourning for the loss of life struck down too young.
Yeah. Okay. I reside over that funeral as well. Then I approach Lunette and say, like, well, what do you wish to do now?
During each of those, I also speak at each of them, at each of their
funerals,
their deaths. Yeah, their funerals. Yeah. This is so sad.
It is sad.
It's very sad. What's funny is that the King Arthur music track is playing right now, Woe to Ruin, at the same time. I'm like, what? How is that happening?
Man.
Oh, the coincidence. But I tell Emrys, well, I guess that is up to our Lord, isn't it?
Yes, I guess it would be. And I guess we should return to...
Salisbury.
To his manor and see what he asks of us.
Yeah, so you guys head back to Sarum and you speak with Earl Robert, or, you know, the soon-to-be Earl Robert, and he mourns your loss, and he's incredibly sad. He entreats you, now that you've both returned and you've suffered such great losses after such a long time in the realm of fairy, he entreats you to stay home with your manors this year and attend to their fields, get everything ready, and then, you know, next year you can return to service as knights. This is fortunate for you because King Nanteliode marshaled all of the knights in Salisbury to his forces. His forces were much larger than the enemy forces of King Serdic, but unfortunately King Serdic fought much, much more effectively, and King Nanteliode was struck down and slain along with many of his forces that year, in the year 508. And with his death, there went much of the hopes of uniting England under a high king, as he was the strongest contender. I think we'll just narrate a year or two into the future, and then we'll call it a close for King Arthur Pendragon. And you guys can tell me where your characters fit into these events that I'm about to talk about. So in the year 509... Prince Cynric of Wessex, a Saxon prince, comes to Countess Ellen's court demanding vassalage or a triple tribute. And Sir Brastius, the old bodyguard of King Uther, is here with news of a tournament to be held in London. The Supreme Collegium of all of England has decreed that there to be a non-lethal tournament, quote-unquote, the first of its kind ever in Britain. What you guys have experienced before were sort of like just knights blowing off steam by whacking each other, not terribly formal affairs. But this is a much more organized, much more formal affair that's being... organized, and Sir Brastius reports that whoever wins the tournament will have the collective blessing of the Supreme Collegium, who, by the way, choose the High King. The Collegium is also going to discuss the matter of the sword and the stone. Let's see. That year, young Robert of Salisbury undergoes knighting ceremonies. Sir Emrys,
I would say I'm present at the knighting ceremonies.
Yeah. Did you decide that you wanted to serve young Robert or King Nanteliode or what? I mean, I guess King Nanteliode died.
Yeah, I would serve Robert.
Okay. So you enter his service. And in fact, you're one of the central knights at the knighting, not actually giving the knighting, but since you had served his father so well. And as a knight with some renown, especially as Cornwall's Bane, mm-hmm. you are given a place of respect. Sir Lunette, are you there as well?
Yeah, indeed.
I would say that by this time, Caliborn has come to visit you, and he's made his romantic inclinations very clear to you. Are you interested in accepting his advances?
Yes.
Then, with your blessing, you and he can get married at that same event, I'd say.
Yay.
All right.
So madness. There is...
All right, whatever.
So there's a beautiful wedding just after the knighting, and the newly appointed Earl Robert actually presides over the wedding. It's quite delightful. The very next year, there's the first tournament in all of England. And do the two of you participate in that tournament at London?
Yes.
Yes.
Awesome.
I will always be at every tournament.
Earl Robert is there, and he brings the two of you along with him. Let's see. The tournament is suddenly interrupted by the crowd shouting, "The sword! The sword!" And everybody dashes away, abandoning the fight, the melee. Everybody rushes to the crowded court of St. Paul's Cathedral, and you see three men standing by the sword and the stone. An old knight who you recognize as Sir Ector, a young knight who you recognize as Sir Kay, Sir Ector's son, and a squire who you don't recognize. And the sword is stuck into the sword and anvil as always. Surprisingly, Merlin the magician stands patiently nearby, not far but noticeably distant from Archbishop Dubricus. A crowd of noblemen shoves their way about, each trying to get another turn to pull out the sword, and everybody fails. The crowd, who's all gathered around, starts getting surly, and at last someone cries, "Let the boy try!" Everyone takes up the cry, "Yes, let the boy try!" So the young squire, who stands next to Sir Ector and Sir Kay, steps up to the sword, and with a small flourish, pulls the sword out and brandishes it over the head. Celestial trumpets blare, and a beam of light shines down from above, and a dove and an eagle fly upward in a spiral.
Da, da,
and not everybody is happy about this. Many of the gathered lords and knights storm off fuming, but it seems clear that many of those gathered have accepted the sign from God, and that they will rally together under this young boy named Arthur in support of his claim to the throne of England. And that's the end of King Arthur Pendragon.
There you go.
Way to go.
It worked, kind of.
Did it.
We didn't intend for it to end this way, but I mean, I guess we'll take it.
I die.
Dan.
So with the end of R&D Pendragon, we usually do a little recap session talking about the game and the events that occurred. So we're just going to turn that into one of those right now. So first off, what do you guys think of Pendragon?
Neil, go ahead, because you're our guest.
It's different. It's very exposition and like narrative based in terms of like the story. Like I feel like I have very little control in what's happening in the world. I'm just kind of like along for the ride, and it takes a little while to get used to. In the beginning, I was like, "What?"
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have no control over the future of anything. I'm just kind of like playing a small part in this bigger event and just kind of like ghosting this thing. It's like almost like watching a movie. Once I got used to the fact that that's how the game is. Like, the game is you are a small figure in a greater story, and you're kind of just like along for the ride, then I was able to relax a little bit more and have more fun with it. But it was really difficult for me to get into initially.
You're going
to
speak.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I have to say, you know, of course, coming off of Apocalypse World and Dungeon World, and this is definitely way different than anything I had ever played. And at first I was a little hesitant about it. As far as what Neil was commenting on, I think I accepted that like very, very early on and was okay with that, you know, considering that it was just more about the storytelling. I was really happy that I got to like work the whole sister missing into the backstory and whatnot. But after like the second session, I found myself looking forward, you know, like, oh, yes, we get to play Pendragon again. Whereas like first I was going like, okay, we'll see what this is all about. It's a little heavy. There's like some crazy stuff. Yeah. But I do have to say, it definitely grew on me quite a bit.
What'd you think, Maggie?
This is one of those games where I didn't feel like I needed to prep as much as I did for like the past characters that I've created for other games. I will say that it's fairly easy to get into. The rolling isn't that difficult to understand. There were a couple of rules in combat situations that were a little confusing to us that we made our way through, but it wasn't that bad. I think that I will agree with everyone else that it does feel more like you are stuck in a world rather, because obviously you are. You have like this setting that you're stuck in and a storyline that you have to follow through as far as the timeline goes. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't feel as like sandboxy as other worlds where you kind of are the adventurer and you take on a story. But I do think that even at that, Stephen did try to allow us to kind of bring our own stories and present them in ways. It was just, I think the combat is very, very harsh. This is a very harsh combat system. And I think that if you're playing it for a long series of time, that it could be a lot of fun because you're playing your sister, you're playing all these various different characters, and you're learning about the lore in kind of through each of those characters rather than like the way that we've been doing it is because we're always trying to keep it as like the knighthood. None of us really did play a lady or just a commoner. So,
or squire.
Or squire. Like, I think it might be interesting to try out some of those roles, and we didn't really get to do that because with R&D we only have like a 6-week series, so we don't get as much time to really divulge ourselves into the content.
I have a little bit of a different perspective. So Stephen, what did you think of Pendergrit, and then I'll divulge.
So I want to read this. This is after the session where we had the trial. There's actually, in the rule book, there's like, here's the trial, here's the glory you earn. There's a postscript, and it says, "Do the knights feel railroaded? They deserve to, for they were. But Uther is the king, after all, and considering that they could have been executed for their part in this, they also ought to feel fortunate." So I think like that actually says a lot about King Arthur Pendragon and like what all of you guys are saying about how you're playing a small part in a larger conflict. Like, to a certain extent, really, like, you are kind of small and dwarfed by the scope of the like multiple decades spanning story of King Arthur and his birth and life and, you know, eventual death and the tragedy of Lancelot and Guinevere and everything. From my perspective, what I'm always trying to do is build you guys into a central role in your own stories, which I think I managed to do pretty okay with Sir Quinn and his company. And actually what I had planned for this session originally, because Sir Philip was focused as a sort of like a political guy, and we hadn't really gotten to see any of that yet. So I actually built this whole like, oh, here are all the people at play, and here are the people allied with Sir, you know, Baragor or whatever his name was. Here are the people who are enemies with him. Like, here's the people that Sir Philip could speak to and build them on his side before having a battle, and it would be great. And then he completely failed that passion role, and it all went completely off the rails. There's one thing that I really like about King Arthur Pendragon, which is that if you go read the King Arthur stories, like either The Once and Future King by T.H. White or the actual Death of Arthur, the book, the Sir Thomas Malory translation, you see knights act exactly the way this rule set causes the players to act. Like, knights who go insane and tear off their clothes and run off into the wilderness, knights who just weep for like months on end because they were morose after a passion fail, all sorts of that stuff is just straight out of the stories. So what I really like about this rule set is that the rules of the game actually create the experience of playing a knight specifically in the stories from these legends. And that's really cool to me, but it's definitely not for everyone because of those exact reasons.
Yeah. Does anyone have anything to comment on that before I take it another direction?
No, I think that...
I did feel really railroaded during the trial scene.
Yep.
Like, frustratingly so. Like, I felt like I could have gotten up, taken down my pants, and pooped on the table and still would have been pardoned. And that was pretty like... I was kind of like, whatever. That was kind of lame. But, you know, the story overall, it was fun. That part I was pretty bummed about.
I like the trial idea, though.
Yeah, that's true.
I was like, oh, snap. And I like the little games with the tournaments and stuff like that, too. It was really cool.
I think that like Pendragon is a great game to play if you've never played a tabletop game before, because not only is it pretty simple to understand as a player, but as a DM, like, almost everything that you have to do is inside of that book.
Yep.
So
it's awesome.
If you've never played before and you want some sort of a guide that will still be epic and have cool moments for the players, then you can do that. But for a show like Roleplay, where most of the fun or most of the interest that I would say the majority of the audience has, everyone kind of knows the tale and they kind of expect what's going to happen coming up in the story. So with that in mind, I don't think it was the best game for like a roleplay audience, but I think if you're looking to play a game and you're not really sure what to get into, and perhaps your DM is the first time ever DMing, like, Pendragon's pretty good for that. I think it's a good guideline to follow. And you can do what Steven did, where you just kind of go off and do your own thing every now and then, which I think is what the last two sessions really were, with the elf portion of the campaign and then with
someone actually, this is funny, in the recent Reddit thread, the Reddit Q&A that I did for last week, someone was like, oh man, Steve, this session felt really railroady, like, you know, how much of this were you forcing players into this? And actually I commented back and I was like, you know, I think you're getting that because many of the sessions are kind of railroady, but actually this session was almost completely on the fly.
Yeah.
Because, like, Sir Lunette rolled a crit on her flirting and her dancing, which basically saved Quinn's life from having to fight Caliborn, and just all sorts of stuff like that. And then with her being blonde and then Caliborn basically falling head over heels for her, even with Bri Allen's brother showing up, was just like something I pulled out of my head on the fly.
That's so really cool. Like,
Maggie, you look great as a blonde. Yeah. Surprise.
Thanks.
So yeah, it's a rule set that does support that kind of stuff, but I think it does always sort of want you to come back to what's happening in this story of King Arthur. So yeah.
I will say that even though it was very railroady in the sense of, I don't know why we like railroads. We like trains, apparently. It was very much like we were stuck in this timeline. I think that you did a really good job of giving each of our characters a story. I mean, people are still going rip Sir Ronald, you know, in chat throughout every episode. And so I think because our characters could die so easily in combat that it left for people being like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen next? Or because our passion roles were such an interesting aspect of the game that like any moment we could roll and do really terribly and madness could happen. Like Emrys going a little crazy, you know, Philip obviously going completely batshit crazy. And so it's just, to me, I think that even though we were kind of on this timeline, we all built a story. We each had our own stories that we told throughout that, even with that. And I think that for the role play community, I think that that's the stuff that they love seeing, even though it may not have been, you know, a unique story as far as like the overarching story.
I have a question for you guys, because it's definitely different, right? I don't think I've ever played a system that hasn't involved some sort of magic or, you know, heavy spell system or, you know, something like that. So that was definitely an interesting aspect, but even still having like the fairy lore in there, that was cool.
Yeah, the low magic setting is really cool.
Yeah.
I like that a lot. I've always wanted to do like a D&D setting where it's like the magic is a very rare thing. And when you do see it, you want to like, if you do have it, you want to hide it until it's like a moment where you need to use it or... Yeah, I thought that was really neat.
Yep.
And I'm kind I love that you took DJ Weed's story and kind of brought it as like one of the main parts of our story, because that's like a completely different thing than King Arthur. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, actually, that's why I wanted to make sure to do that, to like give you guys like build your stories into a much more central thing for the show and like have you guys be these big characters against this background of the Arthurian setting. But actually, the harshness of combat does kind of make that hard to do, because at any moment you guys could just get murdered.
Yeah.
Interestingly, one of the other things about this game system that tends to lead me to believe that it's very much about following along with these events is the XP system. And it's interesting because, like, killing a griffin might be worth, like, 150 XP or something like that. And what that breaks down to is it just gets evenly divided amongst the four people who are fighting it. So, like, that's 125 divided by four is, like, 30 glory per person. And then maybe the extra five go to the person who struck the killing blow or whatever. So, you know, if you fight a griffin who's a terrifying opponent and has a chance to one-shot you, you might get 30 glory if you survive. If you go, like if you're in that trial, 50 glory for each person, no matter what. If you see King Arthur pull the sword out of the stone, like, let's see how much glory that actually gives you. I think we can actually find this really quickly. But my point here is that, like, these events are worth so much glory compared with, like, yeah, glory, 100 for witnessing Arthur's drawing of the stone, 100 for having been selected as one of the 10 best knights to guard the sword, 20 for having been selected to guard the sword by one of the 10 knights originally chosen. So, like, for being a part of the Arthurian legend events, you get way more glory than what you could earn on your own doing your own stuff.
Yeah.
So it's like the rules of the system all sort of collaborate to bring your characters alongside this story. So, yeah. That's just an observation that I had.
So, yeah.
One of the really cool... Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No.
I was going to ask a question.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Neil, let's hear from you.
I was going to say, one of the things that I most enjoyed about this system was the depth of history and lore and tradition where, you know, there's the whole sections in the book about, well, this is how everyone acts. Like, you know, if you have a guest come to your house, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And those are the rules of, like, the world that you live in. Of course, not everyone does it, but that's what's expected. And here's, like, the tradition of honor. And here, there's a lot of culture surrounding it that you could read up on. And it helped to really feel immersed in this story where you could, you know, you walk up to someone and be like, I need food and shelter. And like, oh, well, I have to give them food and shelter even before I ask their name or something like that. I really, really like that. And I've actually stolen a bunch of things like that. And I'm going to be bringing into my other D&D sessions because the depth of, like, culture added so much to this. I feel the need to bring more culture into my other games because of it.
Awesome.
Yeah, it was great.
Wait, what were you going to say?
I was gonna ask a question about. So the question was more to Steven. Like, if I was playing this in a private setting, is there an end? Like, I feel like, I mean, or do you just kind of keep go? You could just kind of keep going and follow the years and historical events. I mean, I just wonder, like, how
so
far.
If you play the Great Pendragon Campaign, which is, like, I think the way that Greg Stafford intended for the game to be played. Here's how far we are through it. Here's how much more we have to go.
Oh, my gosh. So you could, like, really dive in.
How long does it go? It goes from the Uther period in, like, 485 is when it starts. And then it goes all the way. It goes through. Let me just talk to you about the stages of the Arthurian legend. There's the Uther period where, like, might makes right and everybody is sort of rallied behind Uther, who's the High King of the Land. But Uther is a horrible person, right? He gets Merlin to disguise him as this woman's husband and goes and has sex with her, you know, while his army is murdering her husband out in the field. And then, you know, he gets slain in battle a couple of years later. And then the kingdom is thrown into the anarchy period, which is the period that we basically skipped over. And we were just seeing the last couple of years of the anarchy period. And that's when England is tearing itself apart. And there's dozens of kings warring all over the place and Saxons invading. And then there's the boy king period, which like sort of where the Arthurian sort of idea of knights and chivalry first start popping up. And then there's the conquest period where Arthur is fighting to establish his ownership of England, and he goes on wars all across the land. Then there's the romance period, which I think is when he first meets Guinevere, and, like, courtly romance becomes a very popular thing. And what else is important in the romance period? That's when chivalry is a really, really big thing. And so, like, all of a sudden, King Arthur is trying to figure out ways to, like, channel this innate passion that knights have to, like, go and fight. And he's like, okay, no, you have to fight for right. You have to fight for the right things. And then you go into the tournament period after people are, like, after the country has been righted by this massive attempt of knights to fight for the right things, they still have this urge to fight. So Arthur's like, well, shit, what do I do? Okay, fight each other just for fun. And then there's this period of years where people are just fighting in tournaments all the time. And then that sort of starts freaking out. And like people from Lot and Orkney start like basically fomenting strife between knightly families. And so Arthur is like, oh my God, what is better than fighting each other? Fighting for God. So then becomes the Grail quest period and people go out searching the land for the Holy Grail. And not even that works. Even that's like when Mordred, who was Arthur's bastard son, sort of comes back to screw everything up. And then there's the enchantment period. And of course, all through this, like Lancelot and Guinevere are falling in love. And, you know, like Lancelot is like Arthur's best friend ever in the whole world. And so then at the very end of things, there's the enchantment period where, you know, eventually, you know, Arthur gets his heart broken and the scandal of Lancelot and Guinevere comes out and then they have to run away together and Arthur has to chase them. He has to try and fight them in battle. And, you know, Lancelot is like the best knight in the land. So he just constantly kills everybody who he had sent up against. And then eventually, you know, they grow very old and Arthur dies and gets sent off to Avalon. And someday he may return when England needs him most. So it just covers, it covers like 85 years, which is something like four or five generations.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
So yeah.
Definitely a lot. Maggie, what were you going to bring up? Do you remember?
I don't actually remember. I think it might have been something to do. Oh, I think it was with Merlin. I wish we would have gotten to see more of that aspect of things. I know that in the beginning, there was a moment where we kind of crossed paths with him because of the missing child and all of that. But so I wish we would have.
We sort of started a couple years late, which I did in order to get us like to the end of the Uther period through our R&D sessions. If we had started in the actual year 485, then I think we would have seen a little bit more of him. Once he steals Arthur away from Uther, then he basically vanishes for, you know, a decade and a half. And then he comes back in order to usher in Arthur as the King of England. And then he's a much more present figure again. So we sort of accidentally ended up in the period of time where Merlin just isn't really very involved. But yeah, that's a neat part of the story, I think.
Cool. Well, I don't really have much else to say. Do you guys have anything else you want to say about the rule set before we wrap?
I don't think so.
Do we want to take a couple questions from chat?
We could. I should have prompted that earlier. I totally forgot about that. Ask us questions. Go. I guess we could talk a little bit about the future. And that's what we don't know because we didn't anticipate tonight being the last night. I guess the one thing that we do know is that this is Neil's last session on R&D. But
for now,
he's on two other role play shows with Vigil, which is the rebooted Evan, and he DMs his own show with Solemn, with the original. A rebooted original. And then he does Dicing with Death. And am I missing a show?
Misclicks.
Misclicks on Tuesdays. So yeah, you can go check that. Four other shows that he does, all with D&D and role playing stuff. Have you guys pulled any question from the chat? Because it's spammy.
People
right
are
now
really curious about Lunette and the Elf King and marriage and how much glory that's worth.
Someone's asking, how much glory would it be worth to marry the Elf King? I would probably give you 1,000 glory for that.
Wow.
I mean,
should have shacked up with him. Yep. I would have done it.
I said yes, but like the end was really rushed towards there.
Yeah.
So.
I would have owned him even as a dude. 1,000 glory.
It surprised all of us. So let's see. There's a couple of interesting questions I'm trying to grab from chat. This one, Scurvy Logs asks, is there any ranged attack in this system? The interesting thing is, like, bows are acceptable in hunting, but when you're using a bow against another knight, that's considered unknightly, and you'll actually lose honor. So really, when you're fighting your most serious battles, there are no ranged attacks, because it's all about the honorable, you know, man-to-man close combat, which, of course, as we've seen, sort of tends to be 15 rounds of wailing at each other and doing nothing, and then a crit that just murders somebody outright. So I do think it's interesting that combat broke down like that, because it's, again, very true to the stories. But that's the way it goes. And then Ichiri Adrian asked, Steve, when you said that the party had a choice of either remaining in Salisbury under the previous Earl or to go on their own adventure, would you have let them have a more free story? Well, I mean, I'm trying to think about when that was exactly.
That was
when the trial happened. So the idea was that they would either stay in Tintagel, I think it was, and have a greater role in the Arthurian legend, or be able to go back and sort of do their own thing. And I'd actually prepared the encounter with Caliborn for in case they had gone off on their own. And I was like, okay, if they're trying to go back through this forest, they have a chance of running into this thorn wall with this thorn beast, and then through it is this elf. And that's all that I had decided. But that was the idea behind if they had chosen to go do their own thing. That's what I had prepped for them to do. And then I managed to pull it back later when they were going through it again because it was appropriate.
A bunch of people are asking if I would have slept with Neil. Well, first of all, by killing Neil, do I get his glory or no?
No.
If I would have slept with his mom, would I have gotten glory?
Would you have gotten glory for sleeping with his mom?
Yeah, I mean, she owned lands and it was her son. So the glory from Neil has to transfer to someone,
if you get married to her, you get glory.
Yes.
Oh, if it's married, okay.
Yeah, glory doesn't transfer through bodily fluids, unfortunately, okay. JP.
Now I know.
It's not a sexually transmitted disease.
Yeah, now I know. Anyone else see any others? Oh, do you have the stats of Arthur and Lancelot handy?
I wonder.
Are those like what is Lancelot's like sword stat for being the best knight in the world, or the best fighter in the world, or whatever?
Is there an alternate universe where Quinn and Jenna happen?
God, that's probably my biggest heartbreaking of this entire system is that Quinn and Jenna didn't happen because it was perfect.
I never found out about. Who was it? I can't even remember her name. That's terrible.
Adwin? Lady Adwin?
Yes, Lady Adwin.
Yeah.
No, Elaine. It was Elaine.
Lady Elaine. No, so like Quinn was doing such an excellent job of working for Jenna. And like when I introduce a big character and then I leave it open for my players to flirt with that character and have the potential to marry that character. If the character is really important, I don't just want to give it to them. But like Quinn actually legitimately worked his butt off for that. And I would have loved to let it happen. and actually, her current husband was going to go off to war with King Nanteliod and die. And then she was going to be single. And I was going to let Quinn rekindle the flame.
Sorry, Lady Jenna.
Oh, boiling girl, 322. That
was. What happened to your hawk, JP?
I would assume he just died. I don't carry him with me, do I? Does my squire tend to him, Stephen?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, okay. Then I had him with me. He was just hanging out, just doing bird-like things.
I'm trying to look for the stats for Lancelot. I'm sure they're in here somewhere because, like.
Sadimo said, what do you think about the DM rolling against their attributes? I feel like it's really good to keep people in character.
What do you mean? Oh, on personality traits?
Yeah, I think that's what he means.
What do you guys think about that?
I think that's cool. I mean, it kind of shoe-ins roleplay, but it fits the character. I think it builds a character that way.
Yeah, I like it. It keeps you in character.
I mean, it's the reason why I didn't sleep with Neil's mom. To be 100% honest, because my chast is higher than my lustful, and I have 19 piety compared to one worldly. So,
yeah. So there's.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same reason why when Philip asked Lunette if he would marry her after meeting her for like one day, she was like, "No."
There you go.
What?
No, I think there's two things that traits do. One is that you look at them to just guide you when you're doing your own role play. That's just sort of free form.
Turn your cast back on.
Oop. And so,
I think JP definitely took it with the otherworldly. Lunette was also really otherworldly too, but I didn't get as many opportunities, except for at the end.
We toggle our camera real quick.
What's that?
And then when when your trait is above 16 and you're like really, really renowned for it, then it forces you to act in accordance with the trait on occasion. And I think that's actually really cool because before I had played Pendragon, I had never played a game where the character felt so distinct from the player. And like excellent role players can often play a character that feels very different from them, but there's still sort of this idea that the character is always going to do what the player wants them to. And then like D&D has these sort of, well, if you're not acting in your alignment, then you lose XP or, you know, you lose your cleric spells and things like that to help sort of keep you acting the way that you decided your character would act. But Pendragon actually has this system where like the checks and the checks against your stats help slowly move your character in the way that you're acting with your character. Because if you act in a way that is important for the session, then you'll get a check next to that trait. So if Emrys had been very lustful, I would have said, okay, check your lustful. And then it would have slowly accrued to the point where he had a 16 plus. And if he decided, no, I will not sleep with this guy's mom, then I would have been like, oh, roll against your lustful. Sorry, man. You've been acting so lustful for so long that your character would probably do this. I find that really interesting, but I do know that it frustrates some people sometimes.
Sure.
Lustful stuff always makes me think of Sir Ronald.
Did you find the stats yet?
No, I am totally incapable of finding these stats.
Oh, well.
I wonder if there's like a...
You can, if you find them later, you can just post them in the Q&A.
Yeah, I might post them on the Q&A. So I will do a Q&A on Reddit.
Lots of questions about Quinn's sister and what happened to her after we brought her back to civilization.
Quinn's sister married a very lovely knight, and they had a lot of children, and nobody died.
Name Yay!
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sir Emrys actually married Quinn's sister and then had a bastard child with Neil's mom. That's actually what happened.
Oh. That's amazing.
Yeah. Neil's Fuck pissed.
Quinn.
Neil's... All right, cool. Well, let's wrap. This is actually coming up on the hour, so this works out nicely. Wheat, why don't you start us off?
Thank you, Neil, first and foremost, for joining us throughout this session. It was definitely nice to play with you. So thank you very much, and thank you to all the viewers who tuned in throughout the duration of Pendragon. Really look forward to seeing what our next game is going to be. I'm very excited. I'm also going to be doing a one-off on Thursday. Is this official, JP?
Yep, as official
okay.
as it's going to get,
official.
I guess.
All right, Thursday, so we will see you there, and it is JP, myself, Maggie, Caitlin, and Dodger are joining us for that cast, so that should be a good one. I really look forward to that.
It's going to be awesome.
Cool. That's it. Maggie, do some shout-outs.
Oh, man, I want to say a lot of the same things Wheat was saying. I want to say thank you to all of you guys for watching. A huge thank you to Neil for joining us and being a guest, and hopefully he can come on again. Maybe we'll do another one-shot or something where he can join us. And I'm pretty pumped. I'm also going to be on the thing on Thursday, so you guys should definitely tune in. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm pretty excited. And, you guys can check out all my stuff at margaretcron.com. I'm all over the place. I do a bunch of different things, gaming and anime-related. And see you guys around.
Cool. Steve.
Oh, man. So, yeah, to echo DJ Weed, Neil, thanks for joining the show. It was awesome to have you as a player. If you guys haven't seen Misclicks, where Neil and I played Dungeon World together under the GMing or DMing of In Control, you should check that out because it was also delightful to play with you, Neil. So hopefully someday I'll be able to play in a show with you and you can torture me as much as I torture you.
Yes. Yes, it will happen.
Thank you to everybody who watches. It's awesome. We wouldn't be able to do this without you, and it's so fun to see you guys enjoying this. And of course, as always, I don't think I've said it yet, but I'll say it this time, JP, thank you, because I wouldn't be here without you, and it's awesome to be a part of all of this. And it's like one of my dreams to like just play a whole bunch of different games and see what all the different systems are like. So it's awesome that I have the chance to do that with these fine folk.
Awesome.
That's about it.
Last but not least, our guest for this what is this, season? Well, I don't even know what season this is. Fort Pendragon, Neil.
Cycle 3.
Thanks so much for being on, man. Do some shout-outs.
Thank you guys for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed Pendragon. It had its ups, it had its downs, but overall it was a positive experience, and I really feel like I learned a lot as a player and as a DM and as a way to, you know, I really enjoyed this, and you guys are a lot of fun to play with. I hope I can come back for something sometime, but of course, you know, feel free to mix in some other people out there. For me, all I really got is not this Tuesday, the 20th, but the Tuesday after that, the 27th, I'm doing a 120-hour marathon stream. 120-hour long marathon stream. That's 5 days. It's going to be Tuesday from noon
crazy.
Through Sunday the 1st at noon. Tuesday through Sunday, guys. That's the plan. That's all. That's what I'm doing. So check that out. You know, you'll have plenty of time to at some point. That's my thing. Long-term streaming with sleep deprivation.
And for $50,000, we get a combat shovel in Solemn.
No, no combat shovel. Combat shovels are retarded. Done. Over.
Do you have any other shout-outs, Neil? Sorry for cutting you off.
Thanks to JP for hosting Roleplay and creating such a wonderful environment on the internet for all of us D&D and pen and paper RPG nerds. It's great. I'm glad you got this started.
Cool. Usually what? What'd you say?
Nova.
Oh, usually we have a teaser for the next season of R&D, but we don't know what it's going to be or who the guest is going to be. So when we're able to decipher that, we will let you guys know. Wheat spoke about the one shot. That's going to be starting at 8:30 Eastern on Thursday. We're going to be going back to the Apocalypse World campaign, I think, which was a campaign that all myself, Wheat, Steven, and Maggie all really enjoyed. I'm looking forward to jumping back into it as well. And I think Wheat's going to finally be able to DM his one thing that he's always wanted to DM in terms of the setting. So
Crossed. Lots of violence and sex and violence.
Yeah.
Sex.
Should be a lot of fun. Should be a violence. Lot of fun. So we'll let you guys know more information about R&D when we know more info. But other than that, we'll see you guys on the next roleplay, which is going to be Tuesday at, I think, 4:00 Eastern with Roleplay Vigil. We'll see you guys then. We're out. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Toodles.
Peace.